So it says that verse 11, okay? It says that Yishai brought all his sons in front of Samuel to be that he should choose a king from them, and Yishai didn't even think to bring David to before them. He didn't even think to bring David, and he left David out. So he assumed that David was definitely not the one to be. But however, David was the one. God chose David as the one. Okay? Now the question is, the Ralbag only mentions, that's Gershonides mentions, that human beings make certain mistakes and they look at things differently than God. Okay? What I'd like to discuss is, what is the difference? What's the mistake that people usually make and the way God looks at things? In other words, the difference between humans, how humans look at things, and how God looks at things. The Ralbag only says that God looks at things differently than humans. All right? What I'd like to discuss is, what is the difference? More specifically, how he looks at people and chooses people. In other words, Yishai the father thought David was not, didn't even have a chance to be king. He didn't even bother bringing him. But yet God wanted David. So you see that they both made two different decisions in how to choose a king. So in this situation, what is the difference between how the human looks at it, how Yishai looks at it, and how God looks at it? First of all, it is not, God does not make a decision on the future, what he knows about the future, okay? Because that we see by Saul, he chose Saul, and Saul was a mistake. So you see, he chose Saul in the present, the qualities he wanted was in Saul. Saul then has free will and can make decision to do evil. God does not make a decision about people from what he knows about the future. God makes it what he knows about the person now. Okay? But we look at the person now differently than the way God looks at the person. The answer is that we look at actions. Our biggest mistake is that we look at actions and not motive. And God looks only at the motive of the person. The question is that if you look at motives, I mean, practically everybody would be evil. I mean, people do things for self-centered reasons. There's very few people that do it for the right reason. Well, the question is like this, okay? You're asking the question that if you have a good motive, like you want to be nice to a person, but you don't really understand how the person operates, and in your niceness you say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing and you really hurt the person, so you do have good intentions. And I'm saying that it's only based on intentions. Is that correct? Okay, good question. The answer is that, you see, for you to be kind to another person, you have to understand the other person's nature to be able to help them. If you don't understand another person's nature, then you can't help them. The only way you could help a person is with that type of knowledge, that you understand the human being and you try to help the human being based on your understanding of the human being. But in other words, if you do not understand somebody else's nature, it's a high probability you don't understand your own motives. Even understanding your own motives is questionable unless you have wisdom to understand your own motive in all this area. You must have knowledge of your own emotions and your own motives before you could understand the needs of others. That's an impossibility. And therefore, even though if you do not have wisdom, then you will not have wisdom to understand your motives, then your motives will be incorrect. The question is, what is a good motive and what is a bad motive? Okay? There is... there's two ways of relating, let's say, where you want to help somebody, okay? There's two motives. One is that you have a conscience. You were raised in a way that to be nice and to help people, okay? That motive is based on your personality, and it's very self-centered, because the personality is always based on self-centeredness, okay? Every personality is based on self-centeredness, even when you want to help somebody else. It's because I want to help somebody. You understand? That's one type of desire to help. There is another desire to help where I recognize the idea of justice and that there and kindness, where there is a system and I'm obligated, I have a responsibility based on the system to help somebody else. Not because my emotional desire, the self-centeredness, is the cause, but my recognition that I'm part of a system and that I must do that which is best for the system, and I relate to people via the system. You understand? That's a certain development of the human being that when they develop, they have a sensitivity for others through their wisdom, not through their personality. Once you have a desire to help others through wisdom, then you will help others by understanding of others. I'm not saying you can't make a mistake, but your motive would be correct. A person can make a mistake, but the motive is not because of your self-centeredness, which is your basic personality, but it's based on your relationship to the system that you recognize you must be a part of that system. Being a part of that system is to relate to the whole system and to help the system really work. To help the system really work, therefore I must help others in their time of need. And the second way, once you recognize it as the system, then since it's not self-centered, then I think totally of the other person, and I must understand when I help the other person what motivates and what operates and what is the emotions of the other person, so I can help them. That is wisdom, looking at another person. But where there you lack that wisdom, or you don't have it complete, that wisdom, so then you, when you help somebody or you relate to people, you look at people in a superficial way based on actions, and you don't see the depth of the person. And especially in the case of David, where King David was, at that time he wasn't a king yet, where he was very abstract and he lived a life of justice and righteousness, a lot of people don't understand that type of person, and they look at him in the same superficial way. So they only look at his actions. He doesn't really stand out, so there's nothing special about him. You see, of course, on the contrary, the righteous person wants to stay in the background. So since he wants to stay in the background, you look at him, well, there's nothing special about him. But his speciality is only which is in the way he thinks and the way he operates. That is his speciality. You see? That is the difference between the way God... That is what... This is one of the ideas that we should learn from God, that we should try to relate to people and understand people and look at them through their unconscious, through their how they live their life, what drives them. What is the motive? Is it chachma, the ideas of Torah, or is it some self-centeredness that drives them? You see, that is the difference between the two. The question is, not everybody is self-centered, even if they're not wise. Not everybody is self-centered, okay? I'm using self-centered, and I'm defining self-centered different than the way society defines it. That's why you're asking the question. Okay? Self-centered in society is where I do things for myself in action, but I don't do for anybody else. Non-self-centered, according to society, is where I might do things for myself, but I'm concerned and do things for others. You see, that was really the way Yishai looked at it. It's based on actions. You look only at the actions. But my definition of self-centered is I do it because that is my personality to do it. My personality causes me to live, to do certain actions. Even if it's for others, it's for my benefit. It is a benefit to the psychological benefit to the person for doing it for somebody else. The only way to get out of the self is through wisdom, where you relate to the what? All right, I'll explain. The way wisdom affects you in a different way is like this. Let's say, for instance, when we look at the stars, we look at it, it's a very pretty night, it's romantic, causes romance, okay? Different, it brings out different emotions. Let's say an astronomer, when he looks at the stars, he doesn't see that. He sees the stars, the particular of the stars, each star is only there to help him understand the universe. You see, the particulars are not important, just the concepts are important. That's the difference. To the regular person, he relates directly to the particulars. That's what we call self-centered. His emotions relate to the particulars. His personal emotions go directly. The particulars satisfy his personal emotions. To the thinker, the abstract thinker, the particulars are only there to help him understand the concept. Now, insofar as justice is concerned, or kindness, the person relates to you via the concepts. In other words, the concepts tell him that I am part of a system. And therefore, the system, to work perfectly, since the system of free will, good and evil, is dependent on you making decisions, so I relate to the particulars of the society through the ideas of justice, or through the ideas of kindness. You see, it's a different relationship. It's not my emotions, but it's the idea of justice attaches to the emotions. The emotions go via the universals. Through the universals, it relates to the particulars. But the emotions is my feelings relate to everything. Even when I'm kind to you, my personality is such that I'm affected by being nice. It affects me personally. You understand the difference? In other words, I'm not arguing with you. I'm just saying that the self-centeredness, the way society defines self-centeredness, is the way society looks at good and evil. Self-centeredness is where I do only for myself. If I can do for others, that's not self-centered. That's why they make a distinction between acts. You see, I'm saying self-centeredness is the nature of the human, that even when he does something kind, he must do it because because emotionally he feels good about it. It's a good feeling.
No, I mean,
you feel good about helping somebody because that's the way you were raised. You were raised to be nice to others. So therefore that becomes, because you were raised that way, so it satisfies your emotions. You're only doing it to satisfy your own emotions. In other words, some people, let's say, for instance, they play ball, and even though it starts raining, they continue playing ball. So even though it is painful to them, it's worth it, the pain, because of the satisfaction of playing ball. Now, when you help somebody, you might have to do things that are difficult, but it's worth it because of the satisfaction that you get out of helping people. That is the... I understand. But the thing is, the fact is that since you are doing it, the fact is since you are doing it is showing that you're doing it for that benefit, that good feeling that you get. Then there must be... Every human being, when they start in life, must start out that way. That's the way the psychological part of the human works. What you do is through Chachma, you change that and you relate to the physical world through the universals.
Yeah, but you get benefit
from but you're doing it because of the universals. It's not directed at the psychological. It's not directed at the psychological part of you. It's directed at the logical part of you. All I'm saying is that there is a difference between the way God looks at you and the way we look at another person. We make the distinction in actions. You see, that's all your arguments are now, too. That if you do something nice, what's the difference what the motive is as long as you're doing something nice? You only relate to the actions, you see, while God views you through why you're doing these actions. If you're doing these actions because of Chachma, then it's a different action than if you're doing this action because of your psychological relationship to being kind. So what we said yesterday was there are either you make it, in other words, there's only two possible ways of making decisions. Either based on your psychological makeup or in a logical manner, right? So therefore, either you make decisions psychologically so then the psyche is self-centered, okay? Or you make decisions based on a rational way. That's an objective way of making decisions. I look at the world objectively, and I analyze, like all the discussions that we have in class, of exactly what is the most intelligent way of making decisions in different situations. Now, the same thing when you investigate a person, you must investigate not based on their actions, but you must investigate them based on their on whether they're guided by their psychological makeup or they're guided by their logical makeup. It's two different ways of making decisions. So what the verse is teaching us is that God is saying that you should look at the inner workings of man, not their actions. It seems like David, he just acted very, in all the way, there was nothing outstanding. But what he didn't show was his wealth of knowledge in that he was guided and lived by those ideas. That didn't show up, and people didn't notice that. So therefore, Yishai thought for sure he is not going to be accepted. You see? That is what we said yesterday. Now the question is, somebody asked, is that why is it better to do it objectively over psychologically? Let's say I'm being nice to a person. It's the same act. I'm doing the same act. I'm being kind to a person. Why is one better? Okay? The answer is for two reasons. Because if I do it from a logical point of view, then I am closer to God. Okay? But if I do it because of a psychological reason, then I'm not that close to God because it's not through understanding. And the second thing is that if I think that way, I'll make decisions in a good way. So therefore, if I make decisions in a correct way, I'll have a better life because I make better decisions. The question that is being asked here is that it is possible that everybody is innately evil. And they're only good only because of some type of guilt or shame that they have. But otherwise, there is no such thing as a good person. That is the question that is being asked. The thing is that when a person looks two ways when he crosses the street, that's neither good nor bad. That's just practical. It's a practical thing. Okay? And if he doesn't do the right thing, the result is harmful. Okay? Now, I'm saying that Torah is not dealing with a nice person or an unnice person. Because a nice person can, without realizing it, do bad things because of their unconscious or their ignorance of justice or righteousness or wisdom. So because of that ignorance, they can do a lot of harm without realizing it. So therefore, I say that what Torah wants is wisdom, a wise person. Wise person means he sees the truth of a certain act equal. In other words, when he is kind to another person, he sees that act equal to looking both ways. You see, when he's crossing the street. Because he sees that as part of reality, and he can show that that is part, that, in other words, insofar as society is concerned, he could show it's better. We could show it's better insofar as the lifestyle of the person that lives that lifestyle. We could show that it helps you get closer to God and your relationship to God. We could show all these things objectively. So he does it not to be nice. He does it because reality dictates that it is the correct thing to do. That is the type of person that we're looking for. Okay, we're going to do Proverbs chapter 11, verse 1. Okay? It says weights. Years ago, they used to weigh things, and there was a way of making false weights. False weight was if you put a pound on one side and you were selling flour or butter, and you put it on the other side, so you get the pound of what you were selling or buying. But what the seller would do, he would scrape off a little bit from the rock. Hold on, somebody's coming. Okay, so he would scrape off a little bit from the rock, so when he scraped it off, so the person would get a little bit less. And the seller would sell, you know, a lot of pounds of whatever he's selling, so after a while he'd make a lot of money, but it was very, very little that he took off from the other person. So the verse says that's an abomination of God. And he says a perfect stone or a complete stone is his will, meaning God's will. That's the verse. And the first question that we have to ask is, we cannot know who God is. So when you say an abomination, like it's disgusting, you're saying that God has a feeling about this thing, that he feels disgusted. That's an impossibility because we cannot know God. So therefore, the only thing that we can know about God is how it relates to us. So an abomination must be something in the way God relates to us in this world. Okay? Because it can't be anything about God because we cannot know who God is. From my views, I haven't seen it all over, but wherever I've seen abomination of God, it always seems to be that it works like this. Usually, let's say, for instance, you smoke. So you know there's a direct link between smoking and cancer or emphysema, okay? Or if you bang your head against the wall, you're going to hurt your head, right? But there are certain other things that are not immediate. In other words, you don't see the results right now. In other words, let's say, for instance, let's take our example from the verse. Let's say, for instance, you scrape off a little bit of a rock, and you're cheating. I mean, you know, like a very minute little bit. Everybody, you get a little bit, so it builds up. It's worth it for the crook. And the other person is not losing a lot. So the question is, what are the odds of him getting caught? And even if he gets caught, who's going to take him to court over that? You know what I mean? Like let's say you work in an office, you know, and you need a stamp, and you put a stamp on your own envelope. I mean, the odds of you getting caught is practically nil. And even if you get, who's going to bother convicting you? You know what I mean? There are certain things that what you do, the odds of getting the consequences is practically nil. But however, there is a harm in it. And that's what the verse is saying. By saying that it's an abomination to God, you should not think that when you do something that looks like it's without a consequence, that there is no consequence. There is a consequence. And in this case, the consequence is that a person is not static. A person does not stay static. He's always changing. And see, the problem with an evil act is, it's true, the act is bad, but the real harm comes that there's a change in your personality, you see. And once you make one change in your personality, then the next step would be that you take it further. In other words, like, you become impatient and you feel, well, I got away with this for such an amount of time, for months, so I'll take another step and I'll do something more. And slowly but surely, he feels secure that he won't get caught, because he hasn't gotten caught when he did all these wrong things. So then after a while, he will do something where he will get the consequences. It will take him to that point where he will get the consequences. I'd like to try to explain, I'd like to go up on a side point, okay? There's an interesting medrash that says that King Solomon captured the king of the devils and he put him in chains, okay? And the devil was like really upset, you know, that he was caught, and King Solomon felt sorry for him and he gave him a little bit of snuff, and with that he broke his bonds. He got free, okay? So the question is, what are we talking about? I'll tell the story another way, okay? Somebody goes on a diet, a very strict diet, and they stay on the diet. And one day they're out at a party, and there's just one piece of cake, okay? Just one piece of cake. It's not going to ruin the diet. But somehow, once you take that one piece of cake, the diet is over, right? A person gives up smoking, and suddenly says, I haven't smoked for months. I'll just take one cigarette, right? And the whole thing is over, right? It is, but emotionally it's over. In other words, by king of the devils, he means where a person has a strong addiction. When a person has an addiction, so the thing is when he controls the, as long as he controls the addiction, so then certain times he can control it. But once you feel sorry for yourself, that's what it means, he felt sorry for the devil. That's why it says the king of the devils. King of the devils means a very powerful emotion, like an addiction. So you could control it, but once you allow it a certain amount of freedom, then it breaks through. Then it just goes through and you don't have it. In other words, then you lose it. That's it. Okay? That's when it's the king of the devils. Now, the reason why it breaks down, the reason why control works and why it breaks down when you eat is because when you're in control, so you have a certain image of yourself that I'm a person in control. In other words, when you're on the addiction, when you have the addiction, you feel you're out of control. When a person realizes they have addiction, sometimes their person has addiction, they don't even realize it. But when a person realizes they have addiction, he realizes he's out of control. When he starts controlling it, there's a certain feeling that I'm in control, you see? But it's based on an image that I'm a person that's in control, you see? Now, that control is based on, like for instance, on the food addiction, on the diet, that you keep to the rules of the diet. If you break the rules, So then then you're not in control anymore. You lose the image of control, and it's that image that I'm in control that helps you control the addiction. Now, I want to say over here, too, when a person steals a little bit, you see, a person has an image of himself that he's a good person, and he lives in line with the system that he was raised in. Whether it's a true system, a false system, but you are raised in a certain system. Now, once you remove the system in such a way, like, for instance, in our verse, where you're not going to get caught. You do it in such a way where you're not going to get caught, but you already broke the image. You see, you already broke the image of that I'm a good person. Once you broke the image of that you're a good person, then you can move down the line to the next step. And once you move down to the next step, then of course there's a certain point where you will get caught and you will get the consequences. But it is based on on that image that a person has of themselves, that I'm a good person, I'm a person in control. That image can only last as long as you live according to what the image dictates. But once you change slightly what the image is, then you lose the image, and once you lose that image, then you're out of control. Then you're back to your old desires again. Okay. I would like a little clarity on what the idea of image is. Okay. Now, let's say you have a day off and you're just dressed in a schlumpy clothing, right? You know, like what you wear around the house, right? And you look at yourself in the mirror and you have a certain view of yourself. Or kids that wear ripped jeans. There's a certain view. That certain image that they're trying to project and that they actually feel. Then, let's say, for instance, you're going out to a nightclub and you wear a tuxedo and a gown. And then you look in the mirror and you have a certain different image of yourself. People have images of themselves. They have a view of themselves. Or they try to create a view of themselves. They're trying to get an image. You see? I can't use the word concept of myself, because concept is an idea. Here we're talking about a certain feeling. There's a certain feeling that I have about myself. And sometimes these feelings last for a short time. Like, for instance, many times a person that brags is because they have a bad self-image and they're trying to change their own image of themselves. They, no, I don't have a bad image. See, I'm a good person. So they create an image of themselves as special, and the way they maintain it and hide from themselves that they have a bad self-image is saying how great they are and how special they are. So they create images to cover different parts of themselves. You see, people create images to protect, and in this case, it's a good thing if you could keep it up. In other words, if you have an addiction and you could create an image of yourself to control it, so then it's good, then it's a good thing. But that's only as long as you keep up that image. But once that image is broken, then the other part comes out. The question is that really this type of image is not a good quality, because it covers up, because many times the purpose of creating an image is to cover up bad traits that you don't want to be aware of that you even have and you don't want to look at. That's what we mean by the unconscious. It's a part of you that you don't want to look at and don't want to be aware of it. And one of the ways that you cover up your bad image is you create a new image that you are happy with and you think that that's who you are. You see? The answer is, yeah, that it is true, it is a bad thing, but sometimes I could use a bad thing for a good thing. In other words, in the case of controlling an addiction, so then, yeah, I would use that. I would use that to control the addiction. The addiction is killing this person, and now he uses that to get control of the addiction, So I have to use it in that situation.
In other words, a person should use even their weaknesses. People should find, in our society, when you have a weakness, you try and hide it.
We say, no, don't hide it, but if you have a weakness, many times you could use that weakness for a benefit. You know what I mean? Like in this case, I mean, an image is not a good thing because you're hiding a part of you, using it to hide a part of you. But here you could use it for a good thing to control an addiction. That's a, then you should use it for that situation.
Right. So the thing is, what we have to say is, but however, there's a way out of this, is a person that becomes a chacham, a wise person. Okay?
Because a wise person means that he only makes decisions based on reality. You see? So therefore, he doesn't base his things on an image, but he bases his decision on the search for truth and reality.
And the question is, what is reality? Okay?
The thing is that the five senses, in other words, everybody knows that if you look both ways, it's important to look both ways when you're crossing the street. That's a reality. Everybody knows that you shouldn't jump off a roof. Okay? I mean, there's certain physical realities that everybody knows because you could observe it with your five senses. The difficulty is when the reality is based on ideas like consequences, there it becomes very subtle, okay? Now, we say that the study of Proverbs, the purpose, one of the benefits of the study of Proverbs is to extend your sense of reality from the five senses to the world of ideas. In other words, like for instance, a psychotic, he doesn't even have in the five senses. I mean, he thinks he could fly, so his five senses is not in reality. Most human beings, their sense of reality attaches to the five senses. And there's a rare few that get involved in the world of study, where in the study of what we're talking about, ideas about life, then they extend their sense of reality to the world of ideas, where ideas become real. And therefore, they have to show where each thing is real and where, and you know what I mean? And then sometimes you run into probability. I mean, then it's a whole world of thought and ideas and how to make decisions based on ideas. But you can extend your sense of reality to the world of ideas, where you make decisions based on ideas and not based on an image.
And the question is that reality is different for everybody.
That you can only say only in the world of ideas, because a person feels that in the world of ideas things are not real. You see? Because you could, I think this way, you think that way, you know what I mean? I think abortion is good, I think abortion is just bad, you know what I mean? But there's ways of dealing with it and discussing it where you can't show where it's, what is the reality in this situation. If two logical people, not two people that have powerful emotions, you know, on both sides, but two logical people that have two opposite views, if they're both honest, then when they walk away they should all have one view. Because if they're following the world of ideas, both of them are following the world of ideas and follow the arguments and not sticking to their emotions. They're not stuck on their view has to be right, but they're open to ideas and just follow the ideas. Then two people that have that honesty, they could have two opposite opinions, and when they get together, when they walk away, they should have both one opinion.
Right. An example, okay? We have a big fight about abortion, right? To have abortion or not to have abortion, you know what I mean? The religious people hold you should not have abortion. It's death. I mean, you can't murder. The other says you have the right. It's my body, okay? Right. They're both wrong, okay? I'll tell you why. Because the thing is, we're talking about law. In other words, like this. Scientifically, nobody could prove life. when does life begin or when life ends, you can't know that. The scientist can only tell you that the heart is beating, the heart is not beating, that's all. You know what I mean? The brain is working, the brain is not working, you know what I mean? They can tell you that fact. But what is life is a legal problem, okay? So if it's a legal problem in America, we have a method of working legal problems. We have the Supreme Court, we have the Congress, and we have the President, the way we make our laws, okay? So the thing is whatever, however we make laws, that's what it is. It's not a philosophical debate. You can't fight it. How could I prove that there's no way of proving that when a person is alive? So these people say, conception, that's it, it's a lie. Okay? I mean, what do you mean? Well, no scientist could say that. On what basis are you saying that? It's a legal problem. So, I mean, any two intelligent people would get together, they think about it, and say, yeah, okay, so let's, so then that's all, I'll just work with the Congress. You know what I mean? I'll try and change it from, by the law, okay, if I don't like it. You know what I mean? But if it's a legal problem, it's not a philosophical problem. You understand? So the whole thing is, the whole argument is ridiculous from both sides. That's what I mean. People don't know the premises, they just have a certain feeling that it's wrong to have an abortion. And certain people say they have a certain feeling that what's wrong with an abortion? I mean, the child is not alive. I mean, it doesn't feel pain. It doesn't, it's not aware. So it's not a person. So I feel that way. I mean, well, it's a very nice feeling both ways, but it's not based on feelings. Once you come down to technicality, it's a legal thing. You can't know which one is right. Now, if two intelligent people get together, they walk away and say, you know, you're right. But what stops them is their emotions. Now, the question is, we're going back to image. What does this all have to do with image? The answer is that I'm saying that you can control an addiction through image, or you could deal with an addiction in a very rational way. In an intelligent way, where you think about it and work it through ideas. In other words, there's two ways of dealing. One is for a person that just control of the addiction. Control of the addiction, then you must use image. But if you want to deal with the addiction and work it through in the mind, I mean, the different methods of doing that, so then... Then that would be the best way, because then you're dealing with the chachma, and you could probably, there's a possibility of undoing the addiction altogether, you see, through wisdom. In other words, it wouldn't be control anymore, it's not controlling of the addiction, it's dealing with the addiction itself. No cover-up, you look at the causes of the addiction. And you see, you try to cure it, like any, like a scientist. He looks for the causes. Once you find the causes, that's the cure. Then you could cure it. But first, you must find the causes. But you have to find the causes of the addiction. A summary of what we did. Okay, we said that that a person can do a slight act of evil without getting the consequences. It is possible. But we said, in the long run, he will pay for it. Okay. That's what it means, abomination. Then we wanted to know why psychologically must it happen. Maybe a person could stop at a certain point and say, I'll only stop here and I won't go on. I won't become worse, okay? So that's when we went to the King Solomon, the King of the Devils, to show that a person operates by images, you see? And so therefore, if you have an image of that I'm a just person, once you start stealing, you lose that image. Once you lose that image, then you could go further. And then the last step is what we took as we went to the world of ideas, and we said that you won't control the addiction, but you try to find the cause of the addiction and to remove the addiction through the cause. Okay, we're doing Proverbs chapter 11, verse 2. When it says, a man of Zadon comes, there comes shame, and the modest, and when the modest person comes, with the modest is wisdom. Okay, so the question is, what is Zadon? So the Rabbeinu Yonah says there's two types of Zadon. Basically, Zadon is a person that insults others. But there's two reasons why he insults others. Either he enjoys putting people down, or in a moment of anger, he puts people down. In other words, when an emotion is awakened, he can't control his emotion. That's the two types of zadon. Person that insults others, but two causes. One is the cause for one is that he does it, that he just enjoys putting people down, insulting people. The other is an outlet for his emotions. The question is, what's the difference between the two types? The first possibility is that one person is sadistic or aggressive. And the other one, he just lets the emotions get the best of him. Okay? In other words, when you say the emotions get the best of you, you're trying to say that, in other words, are you sadistic? The question is, are you sadistic or are you not sadistic? In other words, the person that only has an outlet for his emotions, he doesn't always insult people. But when he gets angry, he does. Is the question is, at that point, is that equal to the first guy? Is the cause the same as the first guy, or is it different? That's the question. But when you say one is temporary, right, at that temporary time where he attacks somebody, is that what is the cause for that attack? When you say it's just a reaction, when he reacts, he's doing an aggressive act. What is the cause of that aggressive act? The difference is like this, that one person enjoys his aggression. He's a sadistic person. He enjoys tormenting others. Okay? The other one has that quality, but it is not that, but he uses that quality. In other words, that quality, he has the quality of sadism. Well, if you attack somebody, you must have aggression or sadism that's there. But the only thing is, what awakens the sadism is his ego. Okay? In other words, there has to be a situation where his ego was hurt. And when his ego was hurt, so then he uses his aggression to attack. You see, the first guy enjoys aggression per se. He was a sadist per se. You see, the second guy has sadism, but however, he needs an ego-breaking situation that brings it out. The cause is the ego. The ego brings it out. In other words, they're both sadistic, but one is he enjoys the sadism. He enjoys it. The other is just a reaction against his ego. That's the difference between in the explanation of the Rabbeinu Yonah of the two types of zadon. Okay, so of course, when it comes shame. In other words, he embarrasses others. Either way, he puts people down. Okay, all right. Now, what about the tzinuim? Tzinuim are modest people. What does it mean, modest people, chachma? What does that mean? And what is modest here? In other words, modest is not, in this case, the way you dress. Can't be that. So the question is, how are they using the term modest here? The Ibn Ezra says, what is tzinuim, modest? He says, tzinuim are embarrassed from doing zadon. Okay, in other words, from doing evil, from putting people down. Okay? So that's how the Ibn Ezra translates. So the question is, according to Ibn Ezra, what's a tzinua, a modest person? Since we're dealing in Mishlei, so it doesn't mean by embarrassed like a like a person is embarrassed to do something, you know, that's an ego type of thing. In other words, the conscience tells you to be embarrassed. It can't be that. So it must come from wisdom, where wisdom guides you to act in a certain way, and it affects the way you act. Okay? So therefore, he's saying that the wisdom, when you reach the level of a tsinua, a modest person, so then you're ashamed of doing zadol. Now, when he says ashamed, what does it mean? There are two possibilities. One possibility is that, in other words, like this, my conscience could attach to my infantile emotions, that's where it starts from, and then with chachma, with wisdom, then my conscience could attach to the ideas of wisdom. In other words, person doesn't get rid of a conscience. Conscience is there. But the conscience could attach to different things. Okay? So the first thing is that the first area it attaches is that when you train, in other words, the reason why a person can be trained is because he has a conscience. So when his parents train him, so he feels embarrassed or guilty or whatever emotion that controls him. Okay? But then through study, he can attach the conscience to Chachma, where he does something wrong, he's embarrassed because it's against reality, because it's against the ideas. Okay? That's one possibility of shame here. The other possibility of shame is that it's a... I don't think there is any other. I think that could only be the only definition of tsinua. There is a higher level where you just don't react. In other words, there is no awakening of the ego when somebody insults you. That's a very high level. You understand? Where the ego is not bothered at all when anybody insults you or puts you down. Okay? That's a very high level. But prior to that level, your ego is awakened, but however, you're ashamed to carry it out because of your attachment to wisdom. I think when we say that a person harms, in other words, a person hits your ego, it means I have a certain view of myself, a good view, and you remove that view of myself. There's a certain image that I have, and you're, by putting me down, you're removing that image. You see? The person on the higher level doesn't even have an image. He just operates through chachma, through wisdom, and that's it. But on the lower level, he still has a certain type of image, and he could be hurt. The question is that the person that removes his ego, what type of a life does that person have? In other words, what does he have, okay? The thing is that there are three causes for pleasure. There is emotional pleasure, like, for instance, I enjoy winning, competition, I enjoy winning, okay? If I have something that you don't have, it satisfies my jealousy, okay? Then there is a physical pleasure. On a hot day, you jump into a cold pool. There's a physical pleasure, or you're hungry and you remove the physical pain of hunger. So that, or taste, you enjoy taste. Those are physical pleasures, okay? And then there's the mental pleasure. There's the enjoyment of ideas, okay? What the person on the higher level does, he just removes the first level. He still enjoys the physical pleasures, and he enjoys the pleasures and ideas. You understand? But what he removed is the psychological pleasures, the emotional pleasures. The pleasures that cause conflict, those are the pleasures. I mean, this guy could enjoy a lazy boy and just relax. He enjoys the comfort. He enjoys taste. He enjoys feeling satisfied there. He's hungry, and he removes the hunger. He has a certain enjoyment in that feeling good, certain good feeling. But he doesn't have the highs of winning, like in competition, like you have a high, a fire, you know what I mean? Those highs that the psychological emotions, psychological pleasures bring to the person, that he loses. That he does lose. But he still has the other pleasures. He's not a robot. He's a human being. A human being means that he has emotions. And the emotions that he has is in the physical pleasures and in the intellectual pleasures. In other words, the psychological pleasures are the ones that make decisions for you. They make decisions. But then the result, when I talk about pleasure, I'm talking about the result of a certain act. So there's three causes, and the result of those acts bring about a certain pleasure. So the physical pleasures, when I do those acts, there is a certain pleasure in it. Okay? The result is the pleasure. That is an emotion. But the emotions do not decide my life. It's the intellect, it's the world of truth and ideas that decide my life. According to the Ibn Ezra, the modest person is the person that if somebody attacks him verbally, he will not answer. Okay? Now, he doesn't answer. It's not that he's not bothered. He is, in other words, he is bothered, but he controls himself from answering. The question is, why does he control himself? One answer is that if you answer back, that only makes the argument worse. And so the fight will only continue on. If you control yourself, that's it. I mean, what else could they do? So that's one reason for not answering back. Second, the reason why you don't answer, because it would justify the actions of the first person. That is correct. I'd like to give another answer. There are two reasons why you should answer. One is that you have to protect yourself. It's a situation that if you don't protect yourself, you will lose out. It's a practical thing. There's something practical that you could lose. The only other reason why you would do it is because you're reacting to his statement, which is really vengeance. Okay? And so therefore, vengeance is an improper way of operating, and so therefore he'll control himself where there is no practical reason. It's just that he was hurt, and now he reacts based on his being hurt. That is vengeance, okay? That is not justice. People usually confuse vengeance with justice. There's two different things. That is vengeance. There's a practical reason to answer back. So then, yeah, then answer back. You have the right to protect yourself. But however, insofar as vengeance is concerned, that we do not answer back because of vengeance. Now, the question is, why are there Jewish professors on campus that that are anti-Israel? Okay. All right. Now the thing is that. There are two types of Jews, okay? One doesn't know he's a Jew. He's raised someplace in the sticks. His parents never told him he's Jewish, and he doesn't know he's Jewish. So that's it. He thinks he's non-Jewish, period. But when a person knows he's Jewish, that becomes a quality of his character. That's part of him. He can't just say, well, I don't care. It is a quality. He recognizes that he's Jewish. Okay? So the question is, why should he be against his Judaism? It's like a quality that's within him that he's trying to deny. You see, when you try to knock a quality, when you you go against the quality that you have, like Shakespeare pointed out in the play, the woman... I don't remember the exact words. The woman protested too much. You know what I mean? So when you have a certain quality and you start denying it, you see, it shows that there is a conflict about his Judaism.
There can be a few reasons why he wants to deny his Judaism. Okay? I think of two. One reason is that if he knows about the halachos, the laws, then sometimes a person doesn't want to be Jewish because it's too much of a responsibility. So he denies the responsibility. Okay? He's not interested. So therefore he says, so he goes against Judaism to deny his responsibility. That's one possibility. Two is, to be Jewish is a very lonely place to be, because we do act differently. The halacha makes us live a very different life, and in fact a lot of the laws are so that we cannot relate socially to non-Jews, you understand? So therefore, because of all these reasons, there's a feeling of loneliness. And they don't like that feeling of loneliness, so to deny that feeling, instead of denying the feeling of loneliness, so they deny their Judaism. And so therefore, or they can't accept their loneliness. Let's put it this way, they can't accept their loneliness, and instead of dealing with the idea of loneliness, so they deny their Judaism, and so that they should be accepted by the people, so they shouldn't have that feeling of loneliness anymore. Since it's an unconscious thing, there's no way of getting out of it, so he has to spend his life denying it. The thing is that it is not practical. It's not a practical thing, this feeling of loneliness, that if he feels lonely, let him go into a different situation. This is an unconscious feeling. It's an unconscious feeling. It's not based on reality. And therefore, since it's an unconscious feeling, the only way you can deal with it is investigate the idea of loneliness in the unconscious, not in reality. And therefore, since he doesn't do that, he chooses to deny that which he feels causes his loneliness, namely his Judaism. I would say like this. If you just don't want religiosity, you just don't want religiosity, but you know, it's okay that you're Jewish. I would say then the cause is you don't want the responsibility of the religion. So you say, I'm Jewish, but however, I don't hold from the religion. The other person that doesn't want to recognize his Judaism, I would say in most cases that's because of loneliness. We're up to chapter 11, verse 3, and it says, the perfection of the Yosher, we'll clarify what Yosher is in a minute, Tanchein, will protect them. The Seleth abode them, and the distortions or the corruption of the rebellious ones will destroy them. Some English translated as the perfection of the Yosher will guide them. Okay, we can take either one. A Yosher is a person that has a love of learning, okay? And he also, his emotions are affected by the ideas that he gets from learning. In other words, he discusses, like for instance in Mishlei we discuss different traits that a person should have. Through his study he acquires these traits. Okay, so the Yosher starts out with the love of truth, and then the when he continues his studies, it affects his emotions, and his emotions become in line with the ideas of have the traits that a person of truth would have. Okay? Tuma, so the first word is the perfection. In other words, when he has those emotions, they will guide him or protect him. So the question is how. Of course, this opposite side, the corruption of the rebellious person, the English translates instead of instead of the rebellious one, they translated faithless. So I said they are both the same. So the question is, how is faithless rebellious? Okay? There's two types of rebellion. There's a rebellion against authority, okay? And then there's a rebellion against truth, against reality, okay? Where a person acts in a way that, when a person acts in a way that is harmful to himself or to others, you see? So then that person is rebelling, turning away from reality. So since we're dealing with reality, so rebellion is against the rebellion of reality, not the rebellion of authority. And the question is, what about a person like, let's say during the Holocaust, he lost his faith, he lost his trust in God, okay? So would you call that person a rebellious person? Okay? He acts irrationally based on what happened to him in the Holocaust. In other words, let's say, for instance, a person was hit over the head and he became psychotic. Because he became psychotic, he jumped off a roof. Okay? Now, it is an irrational act. It is an irrational act, but I can't blame him. Okay? In the book of Mishlei, we are not placing blame on the evil person. We're not placing blame. That's a separate question of free will, whether you could blame, when and where you could blame a person. We're only saying that there are consequences for living an irrational life. And when you rebel, we don't care what the motive is, when you turn away from reality, that seems to be rebellion. Okay? We're not placing blame on the person. We're talking about a person that the emotions affect his thinking process for whatever reason. He might not have free will, but he will get the, it might not be his fault. It's not his fault, but he will get the consequences of the of living an irrational life, whatever it is. So the book of Mishlei is not here to place blame. It's just to point out the consequences. It's a different value system than we have. We're raised in a society where the value system is placing blame. And nobody corrects anything, they just blame, or they feel guilty if they do something wrong. But we don't look at that way, feeling guilty or placing blame or those things. We only look at one thing. Is it in line with reality? Are there consequences? That's it. The consequences, I shouldn't do it. Or I should train myself not to do it, so I shouldn't have the consequences. If I can't help myself, okay? If I have an addiction, I can't help myself, then I should know. It's not my fault. It might not be my fault, but I will get the consequences, even though it's not my fault. Okay? It's a different value system than the one we usually live with. Once again, so we have a person that his emotions are totally in line with the ideas of his mind. Okay, let's say a person is starting out and he sees the ideas, but the ideas have not affected his emotions yet. Okay, question is, what is the difference between the two types of people? Yosher, his emotions are in line with the ideas of the mind, right? Let's say there's a person that studies and he becomes a chacham. He's a real thinker and he tries to live, he lives the rational life, but his emotions are not yet in line. He didn't reach the level of Yosher, okay? He is not yet on that level. He has wisdom, but his emotions are not in line with it. I would like to know what is the difference between in the lifestyle of these two types of people. The difference between two types of discussions, okay? One type of discussion, let's say if a group of people get together to discuss how to rob a bank, and they'll work out the best possible way of robbing a bank, okay? That would be a logical discussion. Okay? But, however, that is not the discussion that we have in this class. In this class, our discussions are, should we rob a bank? Should we rob the bank? You see what I mean? So, therefore, it's a different type of discussion. They accept a certain premise that and then built on that premise, they become logical. You see? But, however, we question the very basic premises of these people and of society and of ourselves. There's no premise that is holy. Every question must be asked. In other words, if ever the bank robbers that are planning the bank robbery would ask the question, should they rob the bank, then it is possible that they might find inconsistencies in their philosophy, and they don't want to be inconsistent, or they'll see consequences for their action. Yeah, then they could find the truth. And there are many thinkers out there that do find these certain true ideas that help them live a just life. We're still in Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. And yesterday we had the question of what's the difference between the Yosher and the Chacham. We said the Yosher is that his emotions are in line with his ideas. In other words, like for instance, when he sees the idea that you should be kind and act kindly, so then he feels that emotion towards others, of helping others. Okay? The Chacham is a person that's in conflict. Okay? The Chacham is a person that is, that he sees the true ideas, and he lives by the true ideas, but however his emotions are not in line. And therefore he's in conflict. In other words, he forces himself to live by his mind, but his emotions affect, is still in conflict. And sometimes, because of that, his emotions will affect the way he operates. It also affects him in another way. In other words, the Yosher doesn't have to use energy fighting with a conflict. He naturally does that which is correct, so he has more energy to do the correct act. While the Chacham, who's in conflict, does the correct act, but he can't do as much because there's a certain amount of energy that he has that's used in the conflict between the mind and what he sees is true, and his emotions, which are still not in line with it. So those are the differences between the Yosher and the Chacham. We're going to do verse 4. And it says, the wealth will not benefit you in the days of catastrophe, and charity will save you from death. Okay, insofar as charity will save you from death, this book of Mishlei is not talking about halacha, Jewish law. It's talking about certain personality traits. So when it talks about tzedakah, it's talking about the idea of a person, of the Yosher. It continues from the last verse, the Yosher, whereas emotions are in line with the ideas, and he feels kindness towards others, okay? And and a regular person, that even though he's an honest person, he's a just person, but he's not kind, okay? So then on a day, in other words, sometimes by a day of catastrophe, it means a situation comes up where you have to make an immediate decision, and powerful emotions are awakened, and you have to make a decision in that situation. That is what it means, the day of either, like this English translated, days of wrath or catastrophe. In other words, there are certain situations where catastrophe suddenly comes, and you have to make a decision. In that situation, there is a difference between a just person that accepts justice, but has not reached the level of kindness, and a person who has reached the level of kindness. The question is, what is the difference? What's the difference in the nature of a tzaddik, a righteous person, and the person that's a chassid? King David used the term chassid. It comes from the word kindness, that he reached the level of a kind person. What, the question is, what is the difference between these two personalities? In other words, you have to define it in such a way that in a time of catastrophe, when powerful emotions are awakened, there's a situation that comes up suddenly, where suddenly you have to make a decision, you see, that the question is, why is one level will help you and the other level will not help you? The level of justice will not help you to the same extent that the level of kindness would. The first question is we have to ask, what is the nature of the kind person? What does it take to become a kind person? And what does it take to become a just person? Okay? A just person, when he studies law, he studies the ideas, so it's a system which he recognizes that he's a part of that system, and he has to act based on the system. Okay? In other words, I analyze what is justice, and I analyze in this situation that comes up between you and me, what is the just way of acting, and then I act according to justice. Okay? So I'm looking at a system, an objective system that I look at, and I make decisions based on that objective situation. Okay? That's justice. Question is, what does it mean to become kind? Okay? Now, since kindness is... See, in other words, like this. When I'm kind to one... In other words, let's say, for instance, I compliment you, and I know you're a person that has a bad self-image, and when I compliment you, you have to break yourself. Like, it's not a good thing to be complimented. So that's not a kind thing. I have to talk to you in a different way based on your nature. You see? Kindness means not based on an objective system on how to act, but it's based on understanding the nature of the person that I'm trying to help. If I don't know his nature, then I really can't help him. The only way I could help him is if I could read people's personality, and according to their personality, I help them. Okay? Now, to do that, I must have an understanding of my own personality and be able to recognize my strengths and my weaknesses, and know the way I react in different situations. That is the difference. See, justice is a person that looks at an objective system, says, how do I act in a particular system? But I don't have to know the nature of a people. I just have to know what is the correct act. In kindness, I must understand the nature of people to be kind. If I don't understand the nature of kindness, I don't understand the nature of people, and I don't know how to read people, then I can't be kind. I could do acts of kindness, like halacha. Jewish law tells me exactly what to do. I have to give charity, I have to do this, I have to do that. Certain acts. But it's not a personality of kindness. Personality of kindness is you must reach a level where you understand the nature of people, and then you must be able to read it in your relationship with them so you could act accordingly. Now, once you have that nature and you've dealt with your own personality to that extent, then you will be able to deal, and many times as you become aware of it, that removes, in other words, the emotions are removed by simply facing them and recognizing what they are. Many times, that's the way you remove the emotion. So the recognition takes away the emotion, you see. And also, once you recognize your emotion, then you're able to deal with it. If you don't recognize your emotion, then it's very hard to deal with. So therefore, when a sudden situation comes and you don't have time to think it out, the person that doesn't recognize his own emotions can fail in such a situation. But however, the person that's a man of kindness, for one of two reasons, either he has undid the emotion that will affect him, or since he recognizes it, so then it, even though he has the emotion, but it doesn't have the same effect on him as it does if you don't recognize it at all. So he's able to act against that emotion even in a sudden catastrophic situation. That is the difference between the two people, between a righteous person and a kind person. The discussion that we'd like to have, what we're going to discuss today is happiness. Okay? There are two different philosophies of happiness. Okay? One is the American view of happiness, and one is the Torah view of happiness. Okay? I'd like to discuss the difference between the two. Okay? The American view of happiness is, for instance, people are involved completely in entertainment. Entertainment is a very, very important part of American life and culture. Secondly, if you are unhappy, you take drugs. I'm not saying everybody, but a lot of people take drugs to escape from any type of unhappiness. Or if you could afford, if you're unhappy, you go to a psychiatrist or psychologist. Okay? So people, the American view of happiness is you should look and do anything you can for happiness. To the extent that a lot of people feel if they're unhappy, they feel something is wrong with them. What's wrong with me if I'm unhappy? Okay? That is the American view of happiness. I'm not saying whether it is good or bad at this point. I'm only describing what it is. I am not giving a value to judgment of whether it's good or bad. I'm only describing what it is. The American view of happiness is that you should search for happiness, either through entertainment. By entertainment, I mean movies, video games, sports, you know what I mean? All this is entertainment. People, if they're unhappy, they turn, they go for drugs. If they try to find highs, different types of pleasures, okay? They try to find, or they go, if they're unhappy, they go to a psychiatrist. And if they feel they're unhappy, they feel something is wrong with them. It's like the conscience tells you that there's something wrong with you if you are unhappy. You feel guilty about it. And you're right, the American way is that if it doesn't feel good, if I don't feel good, then I have to do something about it. Okay? Okay. The Torah way, in other words, according to the book of Mishlei and according to the subject of Musar, the Torah has a different view of this. They say that the life that we are in is extremely difficult. There's many, many conflicts. Now the thing is that that life is difficult, and there are many, many practical things that a person has to do, okay, to be successful. And the book of Mishlei, or the subject of Musar, deals with working out lifestyle if for practicality and all the things that stop me from being successful in the practical world. So the Torah way is that you should live a practical life. Like you see in Mishlei, they deal with consequences. They don't look for happiness per se. They look for consequences that come about by certain incorrect actions. So you see, the Torah idea of life is that life is difficult and complicated, There are a lot of problems in life, and it's your responsibility to work out life the practical way, to the best way that you can. Okay? And that is all of Mussar, right? To work out your life that way. The Torah holds, as a result of making correct decisions and living the correct life according to Torah, you will be happy. It's not a search for happiness. The search is for practically living your life. Objectively, I'm obligated to make a living. I have to know how to raise a family. I have to know certain things. I have to know how to make decisions. So therefore, that is the book of Mussar. That's the study of Mussar, you see. So therefore, it deals always with the practical, and to be careful of those acts that lead to consequences. Okay? The Torah holds that as a result of living a correct life, of living correctly, and making decisions correctly, then you will be happy. Okay? In other words, the difference between the American way and the Torah way is the Americans are looking for happiness. The Torah is looking for living life correctly, and if you live life correctly, then you will be happy, but it's not a direct search for happiness. In other words, again, if a person lives a halachic life, that doesn't mean he could be unhappy. I'm saying the result of Mussar, that aspect of Torah, the study of Mussar, how to live life correctly, not insofar beyond halacha, after halacha, okay? That is that which will bring you to happiness, okay? It is whether you'll be perfectly happy, whether you'll undo all conflicts, I don't know if it's humanly possible, okay? I don't know if that's maybe for certain people like the Avos, the forefathers. But however, I'm saying that that's what leads to happiness and will make you happy, the life of Mussar. So therefore, the life of Mussar will slowly, through the study of Mussar, will lead you to a better life and will lead to a happier lifestyle. Once again, for clarification, okay, the American way is you should search for happiness. The Torah way is not a search for happiness, it's a search for living life correctly. Now, let's say whether I should go to a psychiatrist. Let's say I'm a wealthy person that I don't have to work, and I'm sitting at home and I'm bored and I'm unhappy. So I go to a psychiatrist. That's the American way. The Jewish way is that if I can't operate correctly in the physical world, there's something debilitating, a psychological thing that's stopping me from acting correctly, and because of that I could harm myself, then I go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist. That would be the difference practically, insofar as when you go to a psychiatrist, insofar as the difference in the American philosophy of happiness and the Torah philosophy or approach to happiness. Once again, okay, let me clarify. According to the American way, I go for psychological help if I cannot live life, according to the American way, if I am unhappy with life. And I could afford or have good insurance, so I go to a psychologist or psychiatrist to make me happy. According to the Torah life, if there's something about my psychological makeup that stops me from operating, that I cannot operate correctly, and I will have terrible consequences as a result of this, so then I go to a psychologist or psychiatrist to help me operate correctly in the physical world. That is the difference between the two philosophies insofar as psychology and psychiatry is concerned. When I talk about the philosophy or the American view of psychology, I'm not talking about every single person in America. I'm talking about most people. This is the philosophy and the view of life of the American way of life. In other words, that is, now there might be people that are different than that, that they don't live exactly like that. That is correct. In other words, you find in Sodom, most of Sodom had a certain view. There was one man, Lot, Abram's nephew, that he didn't have that view. He was different. So the thing is, and I'm just saying in general in America, that's the way it is. I'm not saying every person in America is like that. In other words, the person that's terribly depressed, both views would say he should go to a psychiatrist. But the reason why he goes to a psychiatrist is different in that case. In other words, according to the American view, it's because he's depressed. According to the Torah view, it's because he can't function in the physical world correctly. There's a difference in the approach why you should go. That's what I'm saying. It's two views. In that case, they both come to the same conclusion, but for different reasons.